The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. You can find all the lines and available odds, of course, at the DraftKings Sportsbook app. North Carolina listeners, don't forget, DraftKings Sportsbook is now live in your state. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SBNFL. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code SBNFL. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility, deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
Michael Kist, Benjamin Solak. It's the Kist and Solak Show, presented by SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation.
You are flying high on the Kist and Solak Show, episode 41, brought to you by the fine folks at SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation. I am your host, Michael Kist. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Kist NFL. As always, joined by the best doggone co-host in the game, Mr. 8-Year Streak Without a Bad Day, Benjamin Solak. Follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. Ben, how you doing, brother?
I'm not talking to you. You put pickles on pizza! It's highly questionable.
The one person to question me about this, you, eating your cabbage out of a bowl.
Okay.
By itself.
Let's draw a very clear distinction between like eating a vegetable that's been around for a bajillion years, like that like people have eaten for centuries, versus being like, you know what would improve this like classic Italian dish? Pickles for no reason.
You know what, Ben?
Let me ask you this. Did you go out of your way to try pizza with pickles on it, or did it just, like, happen to you? Like, was it just, like, somebody nearby had a slice of pizza with pickles on, they're like, hey, try this?
I saw it on Twitter, and I was like, that actually looks pretty good, because I'm a big fan of pickles, and pizza's a high-floor food. So that's how that happened. Ben, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to make an accusation pointed directly at you. I don't think you've ever had it because you're afraid to be great and you are judging me based on nothing. You don't have the all 22 on the pickle pizza and you're making judgment.
this is what I do. I just judge things like, you know, rotely, like off of the cuff. I would try it if it was around. Like, I'd be like, I would try this. To me, it seems quite disgusting, obviously. But I would try, like, you know, I have no qualms about that. It's simply, say that it is good seems very, it's shocking to me.
Fire. I said that it was fire and I stand by that take. I don't think it's a hot take.
Wow. You must be one of those cool young kids.
So Ben, today, what are we doing today? We're doing some coaches film review today of this horrible Dallas Cowboys, Philadelphia Eagles game. Obviously, some house cleaning to do first with some roster moves. But I wanted your opinion. I struggled to continue to watch this game in any sort of like set block of time. I was in and out. For me, it was a bad experience, but I got through it. How about you?
There were just generally, in my opinion, so many plays that were just like somebody who was directly involved with the play executed the play poorly.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just, there was a great deal of just poor execution stem to stern. I personally think that Doug Peterson had an absolutely fine day play designing and play calling. And I think Jim Schwartz had a super fine day play designing and play calling, to be very frank with you. Yeah, and that's not a typical take that we have on this year podcast. they came out and they were prepared after a bye week. The team did not seem prepared. Yeah. It was one of Carson's weaker games. Offensive side of the football, pretty much none of the skill position players besides Ertz was giving him much help. Offensive line-wise, I thought it was just as shaky as you'd expect with Vitae there on the outside.
And the things you have to do around that, yeah.
Right. Defensively, I think the linebackers are getting a little bit too much blame. I mean, simply, the corner play on Sunday night was dreadful. Yeah. Douglas had good plays, Darby had good plays, Maddox had good plays, Chandon Sullivan, when he's out there, didn't really do anything. But just, like, there, like, at key moments, the corners just made that mistake after mistake after mistake, just inability to do whatever. And obviously, we know Schwartz's scheme is taxing on his corners, but still, like, this is just, there was poor execution from pole to pole, and you don't win many games like that.
And I agree, and we're going to dive into all of that. First, I will note that the Philadelphia Eagles have designated tight end Richard Rodgers, good old Dick Rod, to return from injured reserve. And they've also swapped practice squad tight ends. So Billy Brown is out. He had a big hive in the preseason. And Will Tye is in. A little more experience, I guess, right there going with Will Tye, who has one of the weirdest, like, have you seen his workout numbers, Will Tye?
No, I have not. Is he on mock draftable?
I think he should be. If not, check NFL Draft Scout, because his pro day workout makes zero sense to me. And I remember this from a couple of years ago. I haven't seen them recently, so I want to see what you pull up there, because I remember them being like gross. Like he ran like a 4.4, and you watch him play and he runs like a 4.8 is what it looks like. So very interesting swap there.
257 ran a 4.57 according to NFL Draft Scout.
I swear he ran faster than that. There we go. I got the story. He ran a 4.47. 4.47 40-yard dash at his pro day. That's what they say at Stony Brook. I think they're cooking the books there.
Yeah, listed pro day results on draftscout.com is 4.57.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. So, yeah, I'm seeing it on multiple websites here. Path Pulpit, times clocked is running as low as 4.47 on a 40-yard dash at the school's pro day. So people are cooking the books there at Stony Brooks. Anyway, so that's a big move.
$100 right now if you can name the Stony Brook mascot.
Is it a big rock?
No. I appreciate the effort. It's a river. It's a creek. It's a Stony Brook.
How do you flush that? How do you make that? What does that look like? Stony Brook mascot.
I'm being sarcastic. They're not actually that. They are the Sea Wolves.
Look, man.
They're the Sea Wolves is what they are. Yeah.
Oh, I see the wolf now. Okay. That makes a lot more sense. All right. I was like, how do you make a river?
They're mascot? Not like the fighting okras, okay? This is a legit mascot.
I mean, Stanford's is a tree, so anything's possible, right? All right. Well, that was a ridiculous opening to the show, and we are going to make a hard transition into the coaches
as per usual
for the 27-20 loss to the Dallas Cowboys. We've seen the tape. We have thoughts. Ben, I want to start with we'll start with some surface level stuff as far as stats go. And you see the Eagles going 4-for-10 on third down, 0-for-2 on fourth down. That's 4-for-12 on money downs, 33%. That's just not going to get it done. And it's really unlike this team for all of its failings, just uncharacteristic of them to convert at that poor of a rate. And you kind of go down the line of the failed ones at starting the game with the bubble screen to Tate. That gets stopped short. The next one is at the sticks to Alshon. There was real sticky coverage by Chidobe Awuzie on that curl there that got broken up. Alshon could not get any separation on that one. The next one just beyond the sticks to Tate on a little pivot route, which was fantastic coverage by safety Xavier Woods. And then on fourth down, Josh Adams is gut stuffed by Jalen Smith. And Jalen just made a real heck of a play on that one.
That was I did not like the play call at the time, but man, that was an awesome play by Jalen Smith.
Absolutely, yeah. And I thought the motion brought Jalen into the hole, and he just came in and made a better play than we did. And that's kind of like probably going to be the theme of what we're talking about. The next play, 3rd and 10, short of the sticks, incomplete to Ertz with Jeff Heath right there anyway. And there was great coverage across the board on that one. And part of why that one fails is you get 3 meaningful routes downfield with 2 of them paired, and Ertz has to stay in and block DeMarcus Lawrence for 2 seconds, 2 full seconds to help Big V. And I've said this several times before about what it does to an offense when you have to leave and help like that. You don't get those three route combinations if you have to help your tackle like that. And it doesn't go in the books as a pressure allowed by Big V, but it doesn't matter. The defense effectively eliminates Ertz from being down that downfield threat and working within those three route combinations throughout the field just because of the threat of Lawrence working against Big V. And then next failed, 3rd and 7 from the Dallas 8-yard line. Boundary side, they run that spot copper combination that I love, where you get that horizontal and vertical stretch with Goddard working the corner post, and the Cowboys were just ready for it. They end up throwing a quick post to Alshon on the other side. Alshon goes to sit it down in front of the safety. Wentz pumps it once and then throws it out front. A little bit of a miscommunication there. Xavier Woods is right there. Ben, the Eagles didn't convert a money down until 5:32 in the third quarter. Now, let's call it what it is. I mean, they were outcoached for the most part, I thought anyway. I thought Dallas had a great game plan, uncharacteristically of them. I'm not crapping on the Eagles game plan necessarily, but the Cowboys were really prepared for this game to take advantage of things on offense and defense. That's kind of what I'm saying.
I would not dispute the argument that Garrett and Linehan specifically coached for their lives. You're not gonna hear any argument from me. They absolutely pulled out the stops.
Maybe the way I said it was more of the way it sounded was more pejorative than it towards the Eagles coaching staff than it really was, because I thought that, like I said, Cowboys did a bang up job.
Right. No, I thought there was one of the better coached game for the Cowboys in the year. But to me, the improvement was they were more willing to do some 21st century stuff in terms of like opening script, which is a big thing that's getting a narrative right now in Philadelphia, or in terms of kind of concepts building off of each other and the cohesion of your offense. I didn't see very many improvements. Still asking Dak to make isolation throws that he has not shown he's able to make. I still thought there was no cohesiveness in the running game. I still thought they have the same issues. I do not think I think Peterson outcoached Garrett, and I think Schwartz outcoached Chris Richard and Chudwinski. What's their Marinelli?
Yeah, I would say more on the defensive side that the execution was definitely lacking, especially from the secondary, and that led. It wasn't so much on Schwartz as people are making it out to be, but we're gonna get into that for sure.
Yeah, as we talked about in the pre-show, simply I thought that especially when Darby was healthy, Schwartz came out with a very nice mix of trap coverages and pattern match ideas and man coverage. The variety that I've wanted to see from him, he came out with. Yeah. And it was successful. And it was successful on the chalkboard until it came for time to somebody to execute.
Mm-hmm.
And simply, you know, they weren't able to pull it through. One huge drive stands out for me, and it was, I believe, the Cowboys' second drive.
Okay.
Let me check that. Pulling no, that. It was their third drive. And so it was the one that started on the 8. You had that incredible Dallas Goedert special teams tackle while he was getting blocked in the back. So the drive starts at the 8. The first play, Eagles zone, adjusts very nicely, strong side to that little isolation route to Amari Cooper.
Camus.
Cooper's up against Darby, right? And Camus Grugier-Hill reads. Camus got full flat responsibility because Jordan Hicks is helping him out
right.
from the hook curl.
Yep.
And so Camus can jump this route, does jump this route with great timing. Fails to pick the ball off. All of a sudden, it's 2nd and 10. And then we've got a situation where Schwartz is in pure cover one man, and his linebackers do. They don't bite on the play action. Bradham reads the screen. He's got great width on the climbing offensive lineman, and he goes to hit. He hits Elliott 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage, and Elliott gains 4 yards.
Yeah.
So 7 yards, Elliott carries Bradham. But Bradham's not able to finish that tackle. And this is a great example, Mike, of... Well, there was a 3rd and 2 that a lot of Eagles fans might remember where Corey Clement gets tackled by Leighton Vander Esch in the backfield. You know, we talk about the extent to which running backs affect the game and how you can just switch them in. Well, sometimes it'd be nice to have an Ezekiel Elliott caliber player to break a head-on tackle and to pick up some positive yardage. So all of a sudden now it's 3rd and 6. On the chalkboard, the Eagles are winning handily, but they've given up 2 plays, given up some yards they shouldn't have had to. And then on that 3rd and 6 play, Philadelphia's got themselves, I think, in a good situation. I believe they're pattern matching on this look, and they are. And Dak's able to hit Amari Cooper coming on the shallow crosser. Ronald Darby does not have deep responsibility. He has short responsibility. Yep. He is in a perfect place to trap this coverage, to deliver a strike on Amari Cooper, and he doesn't make the tackle. And Cooper picks up a 1st down. Now, this drive ends up in a punt. I don't dispute that. But that three-play sequence stood out to me.
Yeah.
Where there is no reason with those three plays. You should have firstly had first and 10 for Philadelphia with 2 yards to go, if not a pick six. Then you should have had a second and 10 become third and 15 if Bradham makes a tackle that he had dead to rights. And then a third and 6 should become fourth and 2 if Ronald Darby makes a tackle. That's very easy. Yeah. And all of a sudden, Cowboys have first and 10. Right? And you know, a big narrative is Philadelphia's offense is not getting helped out with field position, right? They have to go long distances when they drive. It's one of the stats that's being used to support the idea. It's all the defense's fault, and it's not the offense's fault at all. This is a good example of where Philadelphia could have flipped the field very nicely here. Could have gotten the ball back at the 35, the 40, depending on how deep that kick was going.
Or had a pick six.
Or, yes, could have.
Either one.
Or, yes, I don't dispute. Right. Think about, at this point in the game, it is 3-0.
You had 3 plays where you could have had more.
That's the overall point. But yeah. So at this point, it's 3-0. You're already down in the turnover battle by 1 because Carson Wentz pick has already occurred. And the Cowboys only flipped 3 on that pick. So you could have gone pick, hold for a field goal, and then come back on the next offensive possession, get a pick 6, be up 7-3. How much momentum would your defense have at home? How you'd be playing now with a lead, which Philadelphia did not do for the entirety of the game. Like, that pick 6 could have changed the figure of the entire match, and it doesn't happen, and we know what happens. You know what I mean? So, those are situations where I feel like that drive really illustrates an example where I think Schwartz had excellent play calls for the Cowboys being backed up and for understanding their tendencies, for getting his players in good positions, and they didn't execute. And the Cowboys are able to drive that ball all the way down to midfield, I believe it is.
Let's talk about this because we need to talk about this too, because the phrase picket fence is coming up, and this is one of the plays where this happens, where 3rd and 15 from the Dallas 26. The Eagles have on that picket fence defense. And in the press conference, Jim Schwartz said, "We've run this play all year. We haven't given up a first down." And a lot of people called them out for the Titans 4th and 15. That was not picket fence. And that was also Corey Graham blowing a coverage. That wasn't the play call. That was the execution.
I have umbrage to take with Schwartz on the idea that that's not picket fence. Though my taking umbrage with defensive play calls has not gone well for me in terms of recent days. So I should be careful. Here's my thing.
That 4th and 15 looked very much like the alignment of the picket fence that we're talking about. I could see why people could get that confused for sure. Either way, the depth is what people are talking about with the prevent. So whether the call is picket fence or whatever he wants to call it or not, I would agree. However, I also say that is on execution, not on play call, because Corey Graham busted that coverage. Go ahead.
Yeah, listen, and the picket fence you're talking about here is a 3rd and 15 play that becomes 4th and 1. Cowboys were willing to go for it, but had a false start.
Right.
Listen, you may not like the picket fence. Philadelphia had an ability to contact Elliott and make a tackle and make it 4th and 7. That's where the first Eagle had a line on Elliott. He picks up 6 yards. Number one, he's a good player. He does that. Number two, you know, obviously they rallied and whatever, but another guy beats a block, somebody's able to get a bigger chunk of Elliott, and it's 4th and 5, but we're not even talking about this.
Pause it when he's at the 35. He's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Eagles right around him with another 6 behind that. They were there, and they've run this a lot. And I actually tweeted this out too, because on these earlier in the year, Sidney Jones, and this is where I really missed him, he's been playing really aggressive. He was typically the first one getting in on those types of defenses. He would fire his gun and
that's
gone.
A good point. So it's a very good point. My quick 4th and 15 complaint is, while yes, that isn't picket fence, you are playing cover 2,
right,
which is what it looked like at the snap. When you're lined up 15 yards deep and you're playing cover 2, you're not getting connected to receivers as they come through your routes. You're not experiencing the flow of the offense the way you typically do when you're in cover 2. And so, yes, you're playing cover 2. You're not just playing pure this picket fence man idea, this picket fence zone, whatever it is, but you're not in the same paradigm. You're not in the same mental processing state as you typically are when you play cover 2, right? You're seeing things from a totally different perspective. Your flat defender is 10, 15 yards further back than he usually is. It's weird for him.
Yeah.
So you're still playing that's still a sticks defense. I don't care if you don't call it exactly the same thing as the other one.
That's what I mean.
It's very clearly a sticks defense. Yeah. Exactly. So don't feel like, well, it's technically not. Okay, well, it falls under the same frickin' umbrella.
That's exactly what I said, Ben.
Well, yeah, but like that just was a quote that Schwartz said that bothered me, and yeah. I wanted to air my grievance.
Yeah, and like I said, I completely find that reasonable. I mean, the other 3rd and 15 was a screen. They weren't playing picket fence. They had 6 guys in the box, so there's that. And then I think they had 1 or 2 others. One went for a loss. One went for like 1 yard. People are saying it fails every time. That's not true. Jim Schwartz is saying that he wasn't running it on certain things. I mean, it's basically the same. So I'll call him a liar on that too. So I think the truth is somewhere in the middle with that. It's a hot button thing right now because of the press conference and whatnot. So I guess I'm playing the middle ground there. All right, what else do we have here? So, Ben, I was looking at the Colts offense and Frank Reich, and there's a lot of discussion around if this offense would have been better with Frank Reich instead of Mike Rowe, and people are blaming Josh Daniels because, you know, he turned down the job, which eventually led to Reich leaving. For instance, I turned on the tape of that, and I've only seen a little bit, so I want to qualify that, but the Colts had 3rd and 6 as their first 3rd down conversion against the Jacksonville Jaguars, and they threw pretty much the exact same wide receiver screen that we threw to Golden Tate. They just executed. They got down to the goal line. They had 3rd and goal from the 2-yard line. We had 2nd and 2. They ran a jet sweep to Eric Ebron. We ran a jet motion with a touch pass to Nelson Aguilar. Aguilar got stuffed. Ebron didn't get stuffed. Obviously, there's more to it, and that's something that I want to look at. I know it's something that you wanted to look at too, but offensively, mm-hmm. from a play calling perspective, I put on the execution, man. Like you watch this, and dudes at times for the most part just weren't getting open. And that goes for Alshon, Nelly, that goes for Tate. It was a failure, and the blame rests really on everybody's shoulders. And I know that's not what people want to hear. People want to have me yell and scream about Mike Rowe and the microwave offense and everything like that. I don't think it's that. I think it's what me and Ben are saying is the guys aren't winning the individual matchups. How, as a play caller, is that your fault when they are not winning their individual matchups? Obviously, your job is to put them in mm-hmm. a position to win. And that's a conversation that we can have. But to totally absolve the offensive skill players for having a bad game, which they did, I don't think is right or fair to Mike Rowe. And, you know, obviously we'll get into it and we'll reassess how we feel about Mike Rowe as we go through this process. But right now, I'm not ready to declare him dead. Ben.
Yeah, so I think that that's a huge point because my primary, like, I guess, counterpoint to that is, okay, watching the game, we said, man, like, this just feels like the play calling is very stale. The play calling isn't super imaginative. Philadelphia's not getting explosive plays. There's so much stuff behind the line of scrimmage. There's so much quick throw stuff, which I get it. Big V is in. You know, you're kind of worried about the protection. Okay. You know, this play calling doesn't feel great. And then you go and you watch the tape and you say, wow, well, there were really opportunities for players to just extend drives and, you know, 3rd down conversions where, you know, there were a lot of good balls out there from Carson Wentz or opportunities for Yak that just didn't happen. And Carson missed a few throws and offensive line missed a few blocks. And this is just like, you know, everybody's just kind of like messing things up. You know, if it's never hard to find execution issues when you're going through the All-22 with a fine tooth comb. And it's never hard to have play calling complaints when you're watching a 3rd and 5 and you have 6 different ideas as to what should happen and none of them happen. You know what I mean? So it's tough to suss out where the truth is, always somewhere in the middle, to what degree. I will say this, and this is like an idea that I've been like mulling over for a couple weeks now. This offense feels like the offense you'd build when you were protecting a young quarterback.
Right.
Like when you're developing him.
Yeah.
Like when he's in his first year.
Can I ask you for a clarification on that before you continue? Are you saying that from this Cowboys game because some of it may have had to do with how much aid that we gave Vitae? Or are you saying from a season-long thing? Because you said you've been working on it for a little bit. Because I would agree with you, especially in this game, but I feel like some of that has to do with Big V.
Yeah, it definitely became stronger in this game, in the Cowboys game, there's no doubt. And what it generally stems from is this fact that I feel like in a lot of key down-and-distance situations, Carson Wentz is not given the opportunity to read a full field, to make a decision, to extend plays with his legs, you know, to be a franchise quarterback.
Yeah.
And take control of an offense and take control of a game, right? And if there's a weakness with Doug Peterson that's existed before this season, is that Doug likes to smell himself a little bit. You know, kind of we say Doug is a very, very proud dude, right? And a thing that, you know, it can be tough, I think, for maybe a proud offensive play caller and a guy who thinks he has tendencies understood and a guy who really believes in his scheme and his situational play calling a down and distance, you know, if it's a key third and two, which I know we're keep coming back to this Corey Clement screen, but if it's a key third and two.
Yeah. Trust your quarterback to make a play.
Yeah, you are not giving your quarterback a chance unless Carson has an audible at the snap, which even if he did have an audible at the line, there's no reason to call it because as we see on the tape, Philadelphia had two offensive linemen out against one backer. They had it numbers-wise on the right. Chalkboard. But you have, in my opinion, a very strong quarterback, a good player. A player who can create a lot with his legs, a player who can fit the ball into impossibly tight windows, a player who just last year was shattering expectations from a third down conversion perspective. And you do not give him the opportunity to read. And that's where I say this feels like an offense that you would use to protect a young quarterback with the amount of, you know, so like three third downs stick out to me. And you could even go with a fourth down as well. The first one, the Golden Tate, third and nine, it's a wide receiver screen. There's no choice there. This next one, Alshon Jeffrey, third and five. Once you see man coverage, you're throwing the man isolation route. You know, you have to read it pre-snap, but it's going to Alshon the whole way. There's the third and two to Corey Clement, the screen. The fourth and one to Josh Adams. You're taking the ball out of your quarterback's hand on a fourth and one. You're giving it to your undrafted free agent running back who's, yeah, been running hard, but still. This is a fourth and one. You know what I mean? Like you've got a 6'5 quarterback who's never missed a quarterback sneak in his entire life.
And here's my thing real quick. Is it time to take off the training wheels and let him throw downfield on a third and two when you know you're going to go for it on fourth down anyway? Are they narrowing his focus so much that they're not letting him be him? And they're saying, here, Carson, we're going to present this for you. This is what it's going to look like. This is what I want you to do instead of giving him a larger plate to choose from.
Right. So you said, like, is it time to take the training wheels off? My experience of it is training wheels came off in 2017.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Carson was.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. And now my experience of it is, like, you know, if I'm reading into the emotions of the characters, Doug is taking so much of the onus of these struggles onto himself.
Right.
That he doesn't want to expose Carson to like situations where he can lose. Like we go back to Carson's, you know, a game-winning drive, fourth quarter comeback stats. But it's something we've been talking about in this podcast. He does not have a lot of those, and his passer rating in those situations is quite low. And you wonder what it is that leads to that, and kind of, you know, what's the chicken and what's the egg here? Is it that Doug and the other offensive minds in the building experience Carson as being a guy who pushes when he's down in tight situations, so they kind of want to take the ball and the choice out of his hands because they don't trust him as much yet because he's still developing in that regard because he pushes? Or rather, is it that Carson, when he has the ball in his hand in those clutch situations, knows that he doesn't always get the opportunity to make choices and to make plays, so he tries to push too hard and create stuff that the offense isn't really giving to him? You know, like there's a very circular relationship between those two. And we're at this point now delving into the depths of conjecture and guesswork right. That we don't really have a founded interest in. But just generally speaking, one of the strengths of Doug Peterson's offense is that it can simplify the reads for the quarterback and it can beat you pre-snap. And one of the weaknesses of Doug Peterson's offense is that it can simplify the offense and decide the reads for you pre-snap. You know, like there, that is a very double-edged sword because on clutch downs, when you have Alshon, Golden Tate, Nelson Agholor, Zach Ertz, Dallas Goedert, and Carson Wentz, you want to be able to say, Carson, drop back, take 3 seconds, deliver the ball where you think it goes best. You know, if you don't like your read, break the pocket, roll out, go make go dive for a first down. Like, obviously, we get nervous when Carson does that, but also, it's his character, it's his ability. And so, something that I think you've seen as the Eagles offense has struggled this year is that it has devolved a little bit more and more to be reliant on these plays, on these processes that I would categorize as outside of the decision making of the quarterback, that I would categorize as plug and play mechanical plays where you could put in a replacement quarterback, you could put in a Baker Mayfield or a Josh Rosen, and it'd be like, all right, you're a rookie, like it's a key third down, like just throw this screen, let Corey go get it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like that's, and obviously again, like I'm harping on one third and two play. It's the example that keeps coming to mind because I really didn't like the call. But this is not an isolated idea. I think this is something that you've seen now in Philadelphia's game planning for the past few weeks.
So I think I know what you're saying, Ben.
Yeah, I know you're about to make some ridiculous joke. I'm just waiting for it.
Doug Peterson needs to stop ordering the pizza for Carson. And if Carson orders a pizza with pickles on it, you just got to see what that tastes like. You just got to see what that tastes like.
I am pressing the red button on the Skype.
I got the message, man. I can read between the lines with you. Your subtle messaging. I trust me. I get it. Not so subtle messaging is calling out players for their effort on the Twitter timeline. And that's some of what I was exposed to today, at least something that I saw and I think is ridiculous. I'm not going to get on my soapbox about it. I'm not upset with anybody, but...
Oh, I thought you were referring to me. I was like, did I do that? No, I didn't. We're good.
No, because it was ridiculous. And it actually comes back to the screenplay too, where they were like, I don't know if, you know, Jason Kelce and Brandon Brooks, maybe this is the effort thing that Doug was talking about. Like,
when I saw that,
that's a spicy take. Number one, to call out a professional for their effort when it's Jason freaking Kelce, who I've never seen give anything less than 1,000% every play, no matter if he's playing good or if he's playing bad. And I don't know what kind of effort gets him to that spot, because LVE, Leighton Vander Esch, read it and got there before him. What helped the Cowboys offense out in that situation, or the Cowboys defense out in that situation, was the fact that they were running a stunt, and Malik Collins, running that stunt towards the right side of the formation, got himself in a position because he's running the stunt. He's not engaged with somebody. He can go fill that backside lane that cuts that off from Corey Clement. Otherwise, they seal off LVE and no one says boo about anything.
Here's what. You want to know what just absolutely kills me about that take?
Yeah.
It is at this time, it is a 7-point game. There are 2 minutes left and Philadelphia has just driven for back-to-back touchdown drives.
Right. No effort, though.
Yeah, like that, but like so they just hung 14 on the last two drives.
Right.
This is a must-win game in the division for the Super Bowl champions. They're within 7 with 2 minutes left and all 3 timeouts. It's 3rd and 2. Who would ever take that playoff besides Dordell Green Beckham?
Right. Their checks cashed on the sideline. They saw it hit their bank account on the sideline after those two scores. Like, that's what happened. Sure.
Is that the point at which a player is like, man, like this game's out of reach. Like, man, we've just scored on back-to-back drives. It's a one possession game and we have the ball in enemy territory in the fourth quarter.
Dog.
Like,
I'm telling you,
we clearly can't win.
Winning cures everything. Losing makes everything stupid. That's what I've come to realize.
That's a fantastic point. I want to talk about that point.
Yeah.
So Tom Brady and Bill Belichick have won 5 Super Bowls, right? And that's insane. And
never heard of them.
And obviously that's obviously insane, because that level of sustained success is almost unprecedented in the NFL.
Yeah.
The reason it's unprecedented is because you just anecdotally and obviously the Belichick Brady thing flies in the face of this, but you need luck to win a Super Bowl. Like, there are more than one good team in the NFL. Like, you need the ball to bounce your way. Like, you need some, like, lucky breaks to happen. Ask the 2017-2018 Philadelphia Eagles and Keanu Neal's left knee if you don't believe me, right? Like, you just need some things to go crazily your way. You need to be hot at the right time. We talk about this all the time. It is amazing to me how positive many people are that season was a fluke and that this is more reflective of the Eagles' talent level in spite of that luck thing. You know what I mean? Like, you have to be lucky to win a Super Bowl. Absolutely. But to assume that it is non-indicative of the talent level of this team, and really, like, you know, like, I wrote a piece where I was like, all right, the 2019 draft is very important because Philadelphia needs to cycle in some youth at these positions that have really been struggling. I thought that was a pretty measured take. A take that I've seen is like, oh, Philadelphia's team is not built for long-term success. Which boggles my mind. And that level of short-sightedness is just shocking. Like, we have to accept the reality that there is a range of player performance. Like, you know, how good is Ronald Darby? Well, he's somewhere between here and here, right? Like, we don't know exactly how good he is. On any given day, he's performing somewhere in this range. You know, like, that's the reality of, like, being a human. Like, you're not a robot. You don't perform the exact same degree every single time. 2017 saw the ideal alignment of performances at the right times for the Eagles to win the Super Bowl. And if you were to run the 2017 season through a simulator 100 times, the Eagles wouldn't win the Super Bowl 100 times. And if you were to run the 2018 season through a simulator 100 times, the Eagles would probably win the Super Bowl in one or two, because they're a very talented team.
Yeah.
Like there has to be an acceptance that we can't just evaluate the reality of like a team or a player or a coaching staff or a front office based off the last three games. Yeah, there's got to be more than that. This is my measured take that will fall on deaf ears. Thank you for listening.
I like it, Ben. No, it makes a lot of sense to me. And I like that we're not so far extreme with everything and letting losing color everything that we do. And we take our time to look at things and process them and try to look at them rationally. Not saying that other people are irrational, but there certainly are rational takes out there. Ben, something that I wanted you to talk about, and I want to talk about something first. There was a play that I sent you in the Slack channel. And what was that?
Shoot!
Second quarter. Pulling it
up. All right. I'm about to watch it for the third time, remembering that you sent this to me, because I remembered that you sent this to me.
Yeah, second and nine for those following at home. Second and nine at the Philadelphia 18. Dallas has the ball. There's 40 seconds left in the half. So Dallas has Allen Hurns on the bottom of the screen and a nasty split. They've got Ezekiel Elliott lined up to the right of...
Already know the play, actually. I put this play up on Twitter with notes on it, forgetting that you had told me to watch it. But the reason you told me to watch it is the reason I noted it. So this is amazing. We're very smart.
This is awesome. So yeah, you've got the Eagles in what to me looks like a cover three cloud. Ben, can you confirm that coverage? With Darby playing the jam.
Yeah.
So cover three cloud. Darby's got shallow. Corey Graham has deep third over top of him. He's working just outside of the hash. Allen Hurns is going to come at him on a corner flag route, whatever you want to call it, deep out, one of those. And he's working from a nasty split. So just inside the numbers. He runs his post. What they do is they release Ezekiel Elliott into the flats. That holds Darby just enough. So Allen Hurns is able, when he runs that corner out, to get away from the linebackers in the hook zone. And Corey Graham is unable to close down on it. And it goes right in that honey hole, right in the turkey hole in between Darby, who is now bolting back, and Graham. Here's the problem. The Saints are going to run this. And they're going to run that same route that Hurns runs into the same area of the field, but they're not going to let them off the hook with Ezekiel Elliott as a decoy. They're going to give you Alvin Kamara. And what Alvin Kamara is going to do is he's going to release a vertical when he gets outside of the tackles. He's not going to release into the flat. He's going to get exactly in line with his receiver in front of him. What that can do is that can create a rub if you're in man coverage, so it can kind of disrupt you there and throw you off the corner route. It can also have the guy late to Kamara, which is what happened against the Minnesota Vikings when they ran it for a 16-yard touchdown. So he's going to come vertical, and then Kamara is going to get square with the defender, and he's got an option. He can go inside, outside. And Kamara went outside on that one. It burned number two. No, I'm sorry. It was against the Rams. My fault, guys. It was against the Rams. It was against LaMarcus Joyner, number 20. And that's what they're going to do. So they're going to be presented with this play that beat them against the Dallas Cowboys in the red zone. And they're going to get an extra threat from Alvin Kamara. That's what worries me. Corey Graham is slow. That's my only note. Ben, on this cover three cloud, do you think, because I'm
Eagles not, ran cover three cloud a fair bit, by the way.
They did. In fact, they ran it on the first drive that you were talking about with the pattern matching. But so on this one,
that was I'm pretty sure the Darby hit that should have been a tackle that should have stopped that drive was cover three cloud.
Correct. Yeah, that's the one I'm referring to.
Yeah, it was.
Just a question for you, because I don't think he needs to here. But in cover three cloud with that jam defender in the flat there with Darby, because it's a nasty split. He doesn't really have to jam, right? Because he's protecting against an outside release, and he wants to reroute inside, but the release is already inside. Would you like to see him jam there? Because I think that's something that we're not getting on a consistent basis, is guys being rerouted, running free into zones. And that's more of a larger thought. But in this case, I wanted to hear your thoughts, because I wasn't sure, and I also didn't want to blame him either in the article. I was like, look, I don't know if it's this, but none of what, you know, this defense is really intended to do really happened on this play other than just being exploited in its weak spot.
I would be shocked if he was coached to jam it, because you've not really seen them jam anything.
Right.
And so that's not, kind of what I was thinking. That's not what I feel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. You rarely see, like, the only times I can remember Philadelphia throwing jams is in this game when Rasul Douglas up at the line of scrimmage, right. Which makes sense because that's kind of what Sewell needs to be successful.
Rasul Douglas toasted by Amari Cooper at will, by the way.
Yeah, I thought on the broadcast film it was a little better than it seemed, and then on the Ultimate 2 it wasn't.
Yeah.
But here's so this is interesting to me because obviously having Darby there in the flat aligned to the weak side with the halfback on that side helps defend against the running back releasing to the flat, which is something that Philadelphia has been struggling with. I will say, Mike, so this is a late second quarter play in the red zone. If you were to go to quarter one, 11:15, and go to that third down where Dak was super late getting to Michael Gallup on the throw.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the one that Chris Collinsworth highlighted because Dak took like four shuffle steps into it.
Yeah.
You're going to see that Philadelphia is in a cover three cloud style of look. I'm not entirely sure what they're doing to the bunch side, but to that weak side again, you've got flat seven.
This is the
same
way
on
Isaiah
receiver.
Yeah, this is the one I was thinking about. Yeah, definitely flat seven, yeah.
The back is releasing out of the backfield into the flat area. It pulls Rasul Douglas down into the flat. Corey Graham is responsible for the seven route. On both this play and the Allen Hurns play you mentioned in the red zone, Mike, Corey Graham is clearly too deep. He is too deep to break on any routes that are going to break in front of him. It's because he's afraid of getting beaten deep because he is slow. And if you look at...
He's at the 35. The receiver is breaking at the 25.
Mike, I posted screenshots. They had... Schwartz had Corey Graham and Trey Sullivan aligning about 20 yards deep as single high safeties.
Yeah.
It looked like Greg Williams' defense in Cleveland, which is not good news. If you look at that red zone play, Mike, he is about... 3 to 4 yards in the end zone with a receiver that's like 10 yards in front of him.
We often talk about the end zone because it ends at a certain point and you don't necessarily have to defend it that deep.
Right. My favorite like half joke, half real analysis is like the thing about the end zone is that there's an end to it. The end line is there. And so there's no reason to be that deep into the end zone, Mike.
Yeah.
Because if they're coming for that area, that ball would have to be perfectly placed deep and you already have leverage. So get out of the end zone. Come up, get upfield, right? And so, yes, Corey Graham remains bad. Analysis, development, shocking, breaking news. Roto World, Solak claims Corey Graham is still bad. And you can see it very clearly on these two plays. But it's, hey, like we said, Linehan kind of coached for his life here. They had an opportunity to hit that flat seven. Didn't hit it on the first time. Came back to the well.
Yeah.
And got on a key red zone play.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. That was smart on their part, knowing that you can attack Corey Graham that way at all times. Ben, before we go, I'm going to give you a quick minute here to give the elevator pitch on this article that you had up on Bleeding Green Nation because I really enjoyed it, and I think it had something to do with Corey Graham on one of them. The Eagles have failed on a similar concept in the what was that? Four.
No, it was sucking my teeth because, yeah, this sucks. This is really bad.
Ah, so this sucks. Go read it. The Eagles have failed on a similar concept in the Dallas game, the Titans game, the Panthers game, and against the Jaguars. Since I liked it so much, you should tell the gentle listeners about it. The floor is yours, my friend. You have 1 minute, 60 seconds.
Okay, but you have to do the same thing for your article afterward. Deal?
I already kind of did some of it. But, yeah, go ahead. I'll pitch it. Go ahead. You're first.
Right, so if you actually, I discovered this in the Cowboys game. Prepping for the show, if you go to 7:54 in the first quarter, first and 10, Dak had a touchdown to Ezekiel Elliott in the flat route, and he just missed the throw completely. And then what you're seeing is, again, those two receivers backside, running back going into the flat, and then you're going to look like a little pick route, little curl route, it's a curl-flat combo, generating some friction there as the linebacker tries to man cover the halfback out of the backfield. You're seeing on third and short, /4th and short, and in red zone situations, Philadelphia is regularly giving man coverage with their linebackers tagged on the running back, which is not like crazy. Like that's a very common thing. But teams are responding to it by running rub concepts, leak routes, and flat routes from their halfbacks. And the Philadelphia linebackers have been unable to get through the traffic and get connected to those routes. The Ezekiel Elliott touchdown in the fourth quarter, it seemed as if Jordan Hicks had one sniffed out finally. And on his way to get connected to Elliott, ran into Corey Graham because Corey Graham was not moving at all. And then what Hicks does, which is very interesting, is he gestures and it looks like he's trying to pass off Corey Graham and say, Corey Graham, you take Elliott, I'm going to go take Dak on this rollout. And again, on this play, it looks as if Bradham expects Rasul Douglas to go and take Elliot, which is why I decided to write about this. It seems to me, conjecture, because they didn't pull it off, but it seems to me Philadelphia is trying to adjust to those halfback flat routes by potentially pushing and passing that route off to a corner who now becomes the flat defender when they're in zone, if they can do that. Now, they've been in man coverage in these situations, and trying to execute that pass off on the fly is mighty difficult, they weren't able to do it successfully on these two plays that I've found here on the offensive side of the ball. So, Eagles defense got a lot of problems. And another one is that they can't, the teams are continuing to run the same basic route idea against them, and they have not yet been able to figure out a solution. And honestly, I think it's more of an execution thing than it is a scheme thing, to be frank.
No.
But anyway, your turn.
Also agree. Yeah, so go check that out on bleedinggreennation.com. Also today or yesterday, really, since this is dropping on Wednesday, I put up a piece. The title is Saints Red Zone Concepts Present Huge Test for Eagles Defense. And what I kind of went through is I watched every red zone snap for the New Orleans Saints. So we're going to dig into this in detail as we preview the game. But there are some things that I noticed. For instance, Taysom Hill, their backup quarterback, the packages that they use him in, the fact that he can also throw the ball. And last week they pulled out a jump pass with him. They'll run it like he's a running back. They'll run, you know, QB lead power. Yeah. You know, they'll run speed option with him. They'll run the read option with an arc block. They'll run read option with duo and hand it off to Kamara. There's so many different things they do. They had him tight doubles, Ben. They had him tight doubles, and he was blocking like linebackers and safeties at one point. Like, they use him in so many different ways. And the thing about that is, when you have to be prepared for it, another thing that the New Orleans Saints like to do is they like to quick snap on you. So they'll break the huddle, and you're trying to figure out, okay, where's Taysom? Where's Breeze? Where's Michael Thomas? Where's Alvin Kamara? And they hike the ball. Boom, they're in the end zone. They've done that three times this year. They also do it with motion. They'll make it look like he's about to line up as a running back, and all of a sudden he comes darting across and do a touch pass. It's a touchdown. They're really freaking good in the red zone. They'll do intersecting switch releases in the red zone. They'll play with your banjo coverages. They'll do all types of stuff. So go check out this article. Get familiar with the Saints offense, because we're going to be talking about it a lot in the lead up to this game. Ben, say goodbye to the gentle listeners. That's all. It's done.
Bye. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Kist and Solak Show here on BGN Radio. We do appreciate you swinging by. As always, I've been Benjamin Solak on Twitter, at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. He's been Michael Kist on Twitter, at Michael Kist NFL. That's K-I-S-T tomorrow. Eagles, or let's do Saints offense, because you've already got work on them. So Saints offense, Eagles defense. Taysom Hill is the worst. He also might be the best. So get excited for that one. This, if you are running out of gas on the Eagles season, if you are dreading the Eagles potentially going 4-6 against the Saints, by the way, Mike, biggest line spread in week 11 is Saints -7.5 against the Eagles. It's the biggest spread the entire week. It is viewed as the biggest, like the clearest win of all games this week.
The Saints are averaging 42 points a game in the last three games. They've converted 86% of their red zone trips in the last three games.
I'm here to tell you, Mike, that is more than 24. 42 is more than 24, which is our big number. That's a problem. So, if you are running out of steam, if you are worried, listen, the Saints offense is objectively interesting. It's really fun to talk about. It's a well-coordinated offense. So, if you do like the X's and O's that you get on the Kist and Solak Show, then you should swing by anyway and keep the faith. It'll be a fun time. We're going to have a lot of fun. And then, obviously, Eagles offense against the Saints defense. We'll follow that with our final predictions on Friday. Please leave iTunes ratings, reviews, and subscriptions. We are very excited to be building the entire SB Nation family podcast little group soiree team. And so those ratings and those reviews help us out a great deal to get other podcasts up off of the ground as well. Thank you so much for listening. We will catch you tomorrow.
We all we got.
Yes.
We all we need.
True.
Fly, Eagles, fly.
Caw-caw. Rush! That's a throwback!
Throwback!
Hey, everybody. How you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team of Flyers.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.